Okay, we'll call the Minsure Legislative Oversight Committee together for Tuesday, January 19th. We have quite a few things to talk about today. First, I guess, welcome to the Senate Office Building. One technology announcement is that in this room we'll be turning microphones on and then off as we get recognized for speaking. Little switch, it says on and off. Joe, you got that? All right. So it should go pretty well. We have last committee's minutes in front of us. Members had a chance to look at those. Anyone wish to move to adopt those? We have a motion to adopt the committee minutes from October 15th. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Okay, I think we're going to start. I mean, it was pretty widely covered, and several of us on the Oversight Committee also served on the task force, but several of us didn't. And the task force that met for the last time last Friday had some specific recommendations on the future of Minsure that I thought would be helpful for the Legislative Oversight Committee to consider and understand a little bit about the conversation that led to these recommendations. And so we've invited the chair of the work group that considered the Minsure specific recommendations. This is a draft report that you'll have from the Healthcare Financing Task Force. It is not final. The votes are final. None of these items changed. But I just want to give that caveat that they are still putting the finishing touches on this. None of these changed in the voting on Friday, but this is the excerpts from there for recommendations 13, 14, 15, and 16, which were the Minsure-specific recommendations, and then a couple of appendices that are referenced in those recommendations for members to take a look at as we work through the work of the task force in regards to the future of Minsure. So with that, Dr. Lynn Blewett, again, the chair of the work group that, and Michelle, Senator Benson and I sat on this particular work group and were involved, and we can add to the conversation, and then several of others of us were on the full task force and can also add some insights as needed. Dr. Blewett, welcome to the committee.
Thank
State
you.
Your name for the record.
Lynn Blewett from the University of Minnesota.
And proceed.
So thank you very much, and good afternoon. So I was chair of the Seamless Coverage Work Group. There were three work groups, a delivery system, seamless coverage, and access delivery system. We had a very long fall. We met quite often. There were 29 members, and we met almost weekly or every other week, and we covered a lot of ground. I think we had a very broad and deep agenda. We tried to cover as much as we could, and I think you'll see from the report some of the details that we discussed over time. It was a great process. It was not clear how we were going to get to an end point, but we did, and I think most of us were pretty satisfied with how we ended up. I would just preface before we get into the recommendations that one of the things that I really enjoyed and felt was really positive was that most of the committee members agreed on the goals and objectives, which were for efficiently run system, seamless coverage programs, quality care, affordable access. And so having a place where we could start from, I think, was very helpful. How we get there, that's where the differences of opinion came, and the role of government and how active government should be in that process. And that's reflective in the votes, and it's reflected in the discussion that's included in the report. I see at least four members here who are on the committee, and I hope you'll help me out if I get stuck or if there are things I haven't brought up. Most of the Minsure recommendations were in the committee that I chaired, and so I think we'll just walk through the recommendations and happy to answer any questions. And we had, I think there were 31 recommendations, 32 total, 33. And you can see we're starting on recommendation 12. So the first recommendation, Okay, so we'll start on recommendation 13. So this was to expand the Minnesota user fee to on and off the marketplace products, and provided that the legislature statutorily reduces the user fee premium withhold level. So the discussion here was that there might be some incentive for health plans to keep their plans off the marketplace, the MinSure, in order to keep their tax liability or that assessment low. Now, the assessment is spread across all of the plans, as we were told by the health plans, but there was some concern that there was some steering going on of keeping people off of the marketplace, and some evidence, some good information on the individual market being about 300,000 people and only about 60,000 people enrolled on the marketplace. So this was more for leveling the playing field as opposed to a revenue raising. There was a thought that if we spread it across the market, we could reduce the fee. And since it's already spread across the market anyway, why don't we just do it and then and reduce the fee by maybe as much as a half? We talked about the future of MinSure. I guess we're going on to recommendation 14. And it was pretty clear during our process there was some more information and guidelines that the federal government released that provided some detail on what that would mean to be part of a federally facilitated marketplace or the supported state, which we call the partnership model, including that what was once free, so to speak, is now they will do an assessment on the premium similar to what we do in Minnesota, but that assessment would go to the federal government, so a 3% assessment on the premiums. There was some discussion about should we keep those revenues locally as opposed to giving to the federal government to administer the exchange. The other discussion on this recommendation was that the federal government was pretty clear that they weren't going to make any state-specific adjustments to the eligibility and levels of the federally facilitated exchange. So that would mean we probably couldn't do Minnesota Care. You'd have to go 138 to 400% in the federal exchange, and there was going to be no adjustments for any states or no waivers or anything. So it's kind of you're all in or you're not in. And so that lack of flexibility at the state level was something that I think many committee members thought we needed and wanted and weren't quite ready to give up the basic health plan, the Minnesota Care program. There's also some discussion of a privately privatized exchange, and while that didn't, we had a voting process and it didn't reach the 51% voting. It was really close, and the committee recommended that be on the table for consideration, and so that was maintained. But the committee did recommend not to go to federally facilitated or the supported state-based marketplace. Then we move to recommendation 15. This was, there was a lot of discussion because we were starting right during the open enrollment period, the third open enrollment period. There was some hesitation to change midstream during this open enrollment period for MinSure. And so a discussion, what we recommended was that there be an evaluation of the of MinSure after open enrollment was completed, and there's a series of goals that we agreed upon in Appendix XN, which is on kind of the last page, which we had a set of 8 recommendations that should be assessed following the open enrollment period and then to make recommendations following that. And we did rank these in order of priority, so you can see that there be a streamlined process for eligibility determination, culturally competent consumer assistance, consumer-facing portal that's user-friendly and efficient, the IT and governance works efficiently. And so you can see those were the things that we recommended be assessed following open enrollment. Recommendation 16 didn't have a lot of discussion. This is a current IT Executive Steering Committee, which was MinSure and the State Department of Human Services, and this new governance structure executive committee seemed to be working well. It's just codifying that current Executive Steering Committee. So those are the basic MNsure recommendations. The Department of Commerce had a series of recommendations that we also adopted, starting with recommendation 17. And there are three are study language. Some of them, the Department of Commerce has begun looking at the options and studying what data is available. The first one is the rate stabilization mechanisms, including a reinsurance program. The second was whether Minnesota should merge its individual and small group markets, creating a larger pool for MNsure. Consider the establishment of minimum limits on health plan carriers' excess capital reserves, building off the study that was done in 2014 by the Department of Health. And then studying options for more transparency in the rate review process. So those were all study language coming from the Department of Commerce. I think that's about it. Be happy to take any questions on the process or discussion or
any Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And, Doctor, one of your opening comments was you had mentioned something that you think that there's steering going on. What evidence do you have of that? Were there some documents or, I mean, that's kind of a serious accusation that there's steering going on. What did you base that comment on?
Well, the first years of open enrollment, I don't have the chart in front of me, but there was a limited enrollment in MNsure. And clearly there were people off of MNsure who would be eligible for APTC tax credits in terms of looking at the distribution of income in the individual market. So it just, I think there was some discussion of the numbers that why weren't more people going to the exchange, and then the people who were going weren't accessing the APTCs, and we were like about half of the rate of the rest of the country in terms of people signing up and then being eligible for the tax credits on the exchange.
And if I
Representative
Mr. Chairman and Dr. What's that based on? Where did that information come from?
Senator Lurie and Representative Davis, that the Commerce Department provided that information on and off exchange. The income distribution is from some analysis that my research center has done on using the American Community Survey.
And Mr. Chairman, Dr.
Representative,
have you surveyed the individual markets so we actually have some data, if any of that is correct?
Dr. Bullitt.
Senator Lurie, Representative Davids, I have not surveyed the individual market. We do a survey every other year of the total Minnesota care market and ask for, you know, what kind of health insurance you have and what your income is, what your family structure, where you live. So there's some general information available on where Minnesotans get their health insurance coverage.
You know, and then just for some context of the conversation that we had, and I think Senator Benson had something to add too. But, you know, several of the remaining states that are state-based exchanges have looked at and decided to do a withhold spread across. I think 8 states that are still supporting a state-based exchange have decided to spread the withhold across the entire market. And the question as to whether or not there actually is steering is, it is true, that is something that is debated and it's difficult to prove. I think what Dr. Blewett was careful to say, actually, and said it correctly, is that, you know, there is an incentive to sell off exchange when there's a 3.5% withhold on exchange and no withhold off exchange. And so there's a built-in incentive. And we actually talked about that explicitly in 2013 as we were debating the creation of the health insurance exchange here in Minnesota. And so with this construct, there will always be serious concerns about whether or not there is steering. I don't think anybody's making, allegations, but I think that having that incentive there is problematic in and of itself.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. And
Representative Davis.
Could the technology problems maybe have been the steering away because they couldn't get through, or they tried and said, we can't do this, it's not working. Steering have been a result of not anything anybody was doing other than the system didn't work?
Yeah, Senator Lurie, Representative Davids, yeah, I think so. I mean, I think the first years it was really problematic, and you call the health plan, you could get enrolled right away. So, yes, absolutely, yeah. I think there's concern of the incentive with assessments on just on the premiums offered through the exchange.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you, Senator.
Senator Benson.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to correct a couple of things, the prices on and off exchange are the same, so there's really no impact on the consumer as to whether they choose to shop on or off the exchange. Secondly, I don't remember an in-depth conversation about steering, and I don't remember seeing research on steering. And so I would, if that had come up as an issue, I would have clearly raised the significant technology hurdles that were encountered in the first few years as probably having more impact than brokers saying to their clients, yeah, you don't want to use Minsure. We'll just take care of this. I would say technology has a much bigger impact than brokers or plans trying to steer people. And, you know, there were a lot of people that wanted Minsure to work, and when it didn't, they did some workarounds. And so had the steering conversation come up, I would have raised that issue. I don't remember it explicitly while I was not at every meeting in person, and there is no incentive for a consumer to shop on or off the exchange. And so if you're accusing the plans of steering people, then we can have a deeper conversation about the plans. But I don't think the market itself does the steering. So,
Senator Hayden, were you?
Yeah, well, not to belabor the point, I just think that I don't disagree that the technology issues might have helped consumers to make a choice, even if they started at Minsure and couldn't get through. But I think we've evolved because the rates have changed and to reflect probably the true cost of what it does to insure people, that now folks might look at that differently in terms of tax credits and others, in terms of how they what their net cost is for paying for insurance. And I know that we've talked a lot about that and probably will talk more. So I do think that, you know, though I wouldn't want to say, as Senator Benson said, to kind of explicitly say that folks were steering, but I think that we're in a little bit of a different climate now as the rates are starting to truly reflect what it costs to cover people in Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Atkins.
Use that switch there that I learned about earlier, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Doctor, can you walk us through Figure 5? Be on page 28. There's been considerable discussion about whether we ought to move to a federally facilitated, join the federal exchange. And it looks like you did in Figure 5.
Dr. Blewett and members, too, just there's four models here modeled, and that's what Appendix M, too, is the definition that we accepted of the four different models that were being evaluated, if members want to take a look at that for reference as well. But Dr. Blewett, as to Figure 5.
Yep. Senator Lurie, Representative Atkins. So I was the chair of the committee. I didn't do this analysis or this figure, so just so you know that. And so these were the four models we considered across the top, and then the criteria that we had discussed as a group along the side, which was, we can just walk through those, which was the flexibility to administer Minnesota Care. And as I said, the supported SBM and the FFM were not, those are X's, so we would not be able to do that under those two models. The flexibility.
Mr. Chair, if I might.
Representative Atkins.
Thank you. And Dr. I figure it's probably easier to interrupt. Are you?
Yep.
Is that by having these big X's there under joining the federal exchange and not being able to administer Minnesota Care, is that because it would be difficult, or is that because it would be impossible?
Senator Lurie, Representative Atkins, I think the federal government said no, they weren't going to make any waivers or they weren't going to make any exceptions to any state. Okay. You're like, either you're in as in on their rules or you're out.
I just wanted to make sure I understood what the big red X's were, is that that's, so, all right, that's a non, it just wouldn't happen. Minnesota Care would be gone.
Right.
Yep.
Okay. And I'll let you keep going. I just wanted to make sure that before you got too far along, I wanted to make sure I understood what the big red X meant.
The second criteria was flexibility to administer additional subsidies. So one of the things we talked about was to smooth the cliff when you move from 200% of poverty to 201% moving from Minnesota Care into the exchange, that the state might consider additional subsidies. And again, we couldn't do that under the federally supported or the federal facilitated, but would under the current SBM and partially privatized. Flexibility to administer portable subsidies. We also talked about, could we do the APTC tax credits on the exchange and off the exchange? And again, we couldn't do that with the federally supported or federally facilitated, but we could do it with these other two models. State costs for completing QHP-related systems development. I might let Senator Lori take that one. there would be a cost to moving to the federal facilitated exchange and the state-based exchange. I think the estimates were $5 and $6 million respectively. There is still additional cost related to SBM and the privatized. Not clear what the privatized, since no state has done that yet. A couple states are considering it.
That was the nature of our conversation.
Yep. State costs for completing QHP and public program-related development systems. Again, similar discussion in terms of the cost. And then flexibility to invest in the Navigator program. Under the FFM and the supported SBM, the Navigators are run by the federal government. And so, again, that would be less ability as a state and local control over the Navigator program. So that was a negative there.
Okay. And then, Mr. Chair, just to follow up on that. This is going to sound like a horribly partisan question, so I'll preface it. It's not intended to be, but it's the quickest way to get at what the question is. The House and Senate Republicans talked a lot about last session that the solution was let's put MNsure in the federal, give up doing it on our own and put it under the federal umbrella. Was this a partisan outcome with this figure five, where the recommendation is not to join the federal exchange? Did Democrats vote to not join the federal exchange and Republicans voted to join the federal exchange? See how partisan that sounds? How else would you phrase it, Mr.
Senator? Senator Benson and I were the two partisans, as it were, on our work group. So maybe I voted for it.
So my question basically is, did the Republicans abandon the idea of joining the federal exchange?
No, it was sort of characterized as that in the press. But what I clearly stated, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, I'm taking some liberties here, is that because we didn't have a transition plan for Minnesota Care, we really couldn't go to the federal exchange. They have to happen either sequentially or in couplet. And so because this task force was making no changes to Minnesota Care, it would be incongruous to say, let's make no changes to Minnesota Care, but let's move to a federal exchange that can't support Minnesota Care. So because of the incongruity, I said, okay, let's look. And with all due respect, I have pointed out several times that there was a third path. We could have a nonprofit exchange here in Minnesota, and the task force in deference was kind enough to put that option back in. Idaho has a private exchange. It's something Commissioner Jessen brought up before she left. And so there are other ways, and if we can start having in-depth conversations about where we want to go. We did get some of that traction in committee, but by the time you get to the end, you either get a yes or a no on what's before you. And so there are alternative paths forward. Some of the financials presented for movement to the FFN were so narrowly construed as to not be useful in making that decision. But until we decide a path for Minnesota Care, the feds have said we're not going to support it. And that makes it very hard to move.
Okay. And Mr.
And so, Representative Atkins,
I'll confess I didn't read all of the media reports. So the final vote was Democrats and Republicans voting in favor of these recommendations.
Senator
Benson.
If I could characterize it for the whole package and for the whole task force report, no, that did skew partisan, but it did pass. For this, I did vote, and I see some members of the press here, so I'm going to try to not phrase this so it can be easily quoted, but because we can't do anything with Minnesota Care at the federal level, we have a lot of work to do before we can actually make a decision about the federal exchange.
So to kind of maybe just to summarize the Minsure set of recommendations was, you know, we have a set of matrix for evaluating Minsure, and we really do think that we should be serious about looking at how Minsure is performing after this open enrollment period and continue the monitoring of it and take an honest look at it. The federally facilitated model and the state supported state-based model really don't make much sense, is the sense of the task force. Depending on whether the IT rollout and the roadmap starts to make more sense, it kind of a known quantity, we have it laid out how quickly we're going to be able to get, you know, where we're trying to go. If that's not working for us and if we're not meeting the goals set out in the matrix, then we really should maybe pull the private marketplace and see if there's components that we could add to the Minsure and swap out pieces and think of a partially privatized model is sort of the general overview of where we wound up. But for right now, you know, I think the entire task force recognized that there, you know, there have been certainly challenges in this reform, but that there isn't a clear, better solution right now. We should continue to evaluate, and if articulated goals are not met, we should be ready to take a look at whether the private sector has some tools that we could add to the portfolio and move forward more smoothly. That's how I would kind of characterize the general tone and tenor of the recommendations. And that partially privatized, just for members' benefit, it actually was taken off the table about midway for in kind of an odd little exchange that we had. And then there was some buyer's remorse from several of us. Senator Benson and I talked about it offline and said, you know, that was probably a mistake. I mean, it doesn't seem like we're going to have the state-supported or the supported state-based or the federally facilitated come through. If there's no other options, this doesn't really meet with the conversation that we've had. So I actually, Senator Benson and I worked together to make sure that we have that, you know, valid evaluation continuing and an ability to, you know, continue to review it. We feel that it was important. So anyway, so Representative Atkins.
Thank you, by the way, very much, both of you, for I think I was the one member of the legislature who was not on the task force. There was, I don't know, 20, was it 29 members, Doctor, that were on the, so it's a, I really applaud
you
the efforts.
You should thank your leader.
Hurting that many is very, very impressive to me. I have potentially a couple other questions. I think what I'll do is let some other folks share their thoughts and concerns. But I appreciate you putting this on the agenda, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And to the doctor on page 28 on figure 5, on SBM, stay the course, you go down to the fourth and fifth boxes, and there's a dollar sign there. Can we fill in that blank, or are there any estimates to fill that in, those two, box 4 and 5? The total cost.
Dr. Blewett, and go ahead, and I can supplement if.
Yeah, Senator Lurie, Representative Davids, you know, I think that was a discussion we had repeatedly about how long, how much, like what's the roadmap to the end, what's the end game, and I don't know that we ever got a final figure. I think the discussion was it's going to be, we're so far in, it's going to be less than moving, but I would probably defer to IT Minute people on that question. I don't, or Senator Lurie.
Dr. Blute, I think that's about right. It is going to continue to cost, is what that dollar sign reflects, is that we're not done with the IT development. It is going to continue to cost. We're going to have to continue the investments there. But if were we to switch to a state-supported or federally facilitated, you know, the costs for completing our QHP related systems development, we still have to do that rollout, and it would cost more to do that systems development in Minnesota were we to make that switch than if we were to stay the course, was what was reported to us. And similarly for the public program related systems development, it is still going to cost us resources to continue on the path we're on. That's what the dollar sign is, but it would cost us more were we to make the switch to a supported state-based or a full federally facilitated model. But as for precision, we don't have precision on any of those. And given the partial privatization that no other state has really accomplished that, it's just really, maybe she should have a dollar sign, but it's hard to know if it's one or two dollar signs. It's hard to know the magnitude, given that nobody's gone that route to date.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I understand that we don't have numbers today, but that's something I'm going to be pushing for, not so
sure.
much today necessarily,
yep.
but as the legislature goes into session March 8th, we're going to need some numbers to see that. Two other things. One is, okay, we're down to 8 exchanges. Is it Minnesota's goal to become number one?
I guess that 8 exchanges...
Or 8 exchanges that...
8 exchanges that do a withhold across the market. I think there's...
How many exchanges are there
left? How many state-based exchanges
Senator
are
Lori,
there?
Representative, I think they're 15.
Yeah.
15
left. It might be 14. Oregon went to the federally supported exchange, and now they're considering moving back to the state-based exchange.
And Kentucky just left there.
And Kentucky is moving from a federal to a...
Yep.
Or from a state-based to a federal.
Okay.
Representative Davis.
Doctor, I'd like to thank you, first of all, you and the committee for their work on this. But let's just say hypothetically none of the recommendations pass. Let's just hypothetically that none of them pass. Not a one. None of them. Zero. Hypothetically speaking. Where are we then? What happens?
Where are we then? Well.
Dr. Blewett.
With you on it.
We are not going to have another task force.
Oh.
Not this incoming interim, anyway.
I mean, let's just, Mr. Chairman and Dr. Let's just say nothing you've done passes here.
Senator Lori, Representative Davids, I think it's just what it is now, status quo, which is we have, the Medicaid expansion, the Minnesota Care Program, and MNsure. So... I think the concern is without the 2% provider tax, how do we fund some of those programs in the future, specifically Minnesota Care? But other than that, it seems like we stay the course as is.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and
Representative
Dr.
Davids. Yeah. Other questions of members? Comments? Representative Adkins.
There, Mr. Chairman, Doctor, I've got a colleague, I believe he was from Arkansas, who talked about the prospect of the premium withhold on the federal exchange moving upwards to 6% or more.
Yeah.
That's not reflected in this matrix, but the ours is 3.5, capped at 3.5. Was there any discussion of that as being a possibility?
Dr. Blewett?
Senator Lori, Representative Atkins, during our deliberations, that information that the federal government would be charging, or the assessment, it's a 3% assessment. I think there's rumors and discussion across the state-based exchanges who are thinking about FFM that could potentially go up as they want more information or they want to do comparisons or they want data. I mean, it's a concern of it's probably not going to go down, so how much would it go up? But the current rate right now is 3%. That's published.
Well, I think that what Representative Atkins is talking about wasn't really discussed because it's not something that we were interested in.
Mm-hmm.
So there's, if you're doing the supported state-based model, it's a flat 3%. If you're doing the federally facilitated, it's the same 3.5% that we have right now. The supported state-based at 3% leaves a lot of pieces off the table and is really too much money for what they're delivering through the federal exchange. There is a conversation at the federal level to add another 2% on top of the 3.5% if a state is taking advantage of the eligibility and enrollment modules made available by the feds. And that's not something that Minnesota was contemplating, so we didn't really have that. But I think that's what you're talking about. There are several states that do absolutely nothing, and the feds pick up the eligibility and enrollment component of exchange operations on top of this. And you'll see in our estimates, I mean, we're looking at the eligibility and enrollment still falling on the state, and we're bearing the cost of that. I mean, we could have entered another whole set of conversation, but I'm pretty sure that's where I think that's the avenue that you're pursuing.
Exactly. I just wanted to make sure we were talking apples to apples comparison, because if we drop what we're doing and have the feds do it, then I've heard at a minimum it's the 5.5. It's 3.5 plus additional 2 for the eligibility enrollment pieces. And then there's been talk elsewhere that that number is even going up to 6 or 7 or whatever the amount is. And I didn't know if that, I didn't see that reflected in the matrices, so I was curious if that had been fully fleshed out. It sounds like we didn't even go that far, because once Minnesota Care would have to be in the trash can, that kind of settled people's minds. And everybody said, well, we can't go down that path. So, but I just wanted to ensure that there had been some fleshing out of how much that cost was going to be if we went down the federal path. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions, comments of members? Seeing none, Dr. Blewett, thank you very much for coming and presenting and for chairing that work group.
Thank you.
It was a lot of work, and we all worked very hard and quite collaboratively, actually. I was very impressed with our work group and the entire task force.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next, we're going to get sort of an overview to start with, and then it'll transition into a discussion. We'll invite Minsure, DHS, and Minute up to the podium, and we'll, you know, maybe swap out, you know, get the opening statements and maybe swap out staff as questions come up and need to be answered. Welcome to the committee. I'll let you guys choose who takes the lead.
Thank you.
Ms. O'Toole, welcome.
I will kick it off here. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. Thank you for having us here today. As you know, I'm Allison O'Toole. I'm the Minsure CEO. I'm joined today by Peter Benner, who is our board chair. When I spoke with you last, we were just a couple of weeks away from the beginning of our third open enrollment period. And today, we're just a couple of weeks away from the close of it. I'm happy to report we're experiencing a successful open enrollment period. That being said, we always continue to learn on how we can better serve Minnesotans. But a quick update on how things are going. From November 1st, 2015 through January 15th, Minsure has enrolled 75,000 Minnesotans into private health insurance coverage. In addition, more than 45,000 Minnesotans have newly enrolled in medical assistance, and more than 19,000 have newly enrolled in Minnesota Care. Those are good, strong numbers. Our preliminary numbers indicate more than 40% of our private plan enrollees are new to Minsure in 2016. Minnesota currently leads the nation with the percentage of new enrollees. Additionally, about 70% of our private plan enrollees qualify for advanced premium tax credits, and that's up from 55% last year. This savings available only through Minsure, totaled nearly $50 million in 2015. These tax credits provide an immediate monthly discount for Minnesotans purchasing private health insurance coverage, and can help lessen or even completely eliminate large premium increases that we're seeing this year. This percentage also indicates Minnesotans are heeding the message to shop and compare, and they're saving money. Our enrollment numbers to date put us within striking distance of our goal of 83,000 enrollments into private coverage. And as you know, this enrollment goal is important, that number is important, but what goes into our budget is also the average monthly premium, which is trending much higher than projected to date. To put our numbers into context, At the end of the last open enrollment period in February 2015, MinSure had enrolled about 60,000 Minnesotans into private coverage, and today, again, we have 75,000 already. This all being said, we still have work to do. These final 2 weeks will be critical for us, and I'm confident we'll end this open enrollment period strong. Much of the credit for our increase in enrollment to date goes to our partners, to the hundreds of navigators, brokers, and grantees across the state doing outreach, education, and enrollment work. Through December, these assisters reached nearly 300,000 Minnesotans with MinSure education and enrollment information. Our grantees alone have executed more than 3,100 outreach activities and assisted more than 21,000 individuals with a MinSure application. Our Broker Enrollment Center initiative, which is the first of the kind of its kind in the country, includes 20 broker offices around the state this year, and together this group has enrolled more than 3,300 Minnesotans into private coverage to date, and they continue to be busy. With an increase in enrollees, particularly an increase in enrollees new to MinSure, comes an increase in customer service needs. And it's likely no surprise to anyone on this committee that the volume of incoming calls to MinSure to our contact center during the final days of 2015 was very high. At our peak, we took 10,000 incoming calls. As a result, call wait times increased more than we consider to be acceptable. On the evening of December 28th, our deadline for January 1st coverage, our average wait times hovered around 60 minutes. And again, this is unacceptable. A number of factors went into the increase in both calls and wait times at the end of the year. These are not excuses, they are facts. They include a converging of deadlines between MinSure's deadline for January 1st coverage and DHS's deadline to respond to renewal information. MinSure also experienced a larger than normal absence in agents from our overflow vendor due to weather conditions. And at the time, many compared this with the customer service levels of our launch in October of 2013. And it's really important to note that in December 2013, our average wait time was unacceptable, but for the month of December, it was 1 hour and 2 minutes. Our average wait time in December of 2015 was 14 minutes and 23 seconds. There is room for improvement, no doubt, but we have not reverted to the customer service levels of old. We know those reasons, though factual, provide little comfort for Minnesotans who spent a large time waiting on the phone to get their questions answered. And we are working with our overflow vendor, as well as our partners at DHS, to ensure that this type of experience doesn't happen again as we near the final deadline on January 31st. And we already have proof. As you know, we had our second deadline last Friday. We answered more than 4,600 calls with an average wait time of just 6 minutes. As we look to January 31st, we'll have extended hours and all hands on deck from our vendor and at MinSure. Aside from these busy deadline times, our contact center has performed well. Our caller wait times have been in line with industry standards, with more than 95% of our calls waiting less than 5 minutes on average. I'm pleased with the work of our contact center staff and thank them for their continued efforts. I also want to give you a quick update on a letter I sent all of you a month ago regarding a corrective action plan from SSIO regarding reconciliation of approximately $500,000 spent on one-time construction and renovation costs. As a point of reference, $500,000 is 0.2% of our total grant funding. As you'll recall, these costs were for essential items like HVAC, electrical, building security, heating, water, fire sprinkler systems, IT ventilation, and IT room buildouts. Many of these costs were to comply with federal safety and security regulations. Based on information provided by SSIO, we are expecting further reconciliation instructions from the federal government within the next several weeks. CISIO reiterated to us that we're not alone in waiting for this information, that three other states are in the same situation, and you have my word that I will update the committee when we have further information about that. On the IT development front, I'll let Scott Peterson fill you in on the progress on METS, the Minnesota Eligibility Technology System, which is our shared eligibility system. Suffice it to say right now, though, that Scott and his team continue to deploy successfully and on time. They made significant progress in 2015, and there's more to come. I'll leave the details to him, but I appreciate his tremendous efforts. On the budget front, as far as our budget is concerned, and as we near the second half of the fiscal year, the Minsher Board of Directors will once again start the process of developing a three-year financial plan scheduled to be released in March. This will look out through June of 2018, which is 18 months after our federal grants expire. A full fiscal year 2017 budget will also be approved and published in July. As I've stated in the past, our board and executive leadership team is committed to ensuring we operate within our means. This means if revenues don't meet expenditures, we make hard decisions, period. Enrollment projections continue to fluctuate as time goes on, but I do feel good about where we are now in the process. Looking ahead to the next several weeks, our work does not let up. We are actively working to get 48,000 1095A forms in the mail at the end of the month. This form will be sent to any Minnesotan enrolled in a qualified health plan through MNsure during 2015. While we want to get this important tax information in the hands of Minnesotans as soon as possible, we also want to make sure the information provided is as accurate as possible. And we're working daily with our carrier and federal partners to ensure that this major project is completed accurately and in a timely fashion. One final note, just to put on the committee's radar. Last week, MNsure staff and I met with the Legislative Auditor's Office. They are conducting an annual financial audit of MNsure as required by law. We welcome the review and are fully cooperating, and we expect a final report to be available at the end of March or so. I will update the committee with whatever information I have as we go along in the process that's available. And just finally, thank you again for having me here. As I've said numerous times, as MNsure's CEO, my eyes are focused on improving the customer experience, managing and implementing a smart, balanced budget, and making sure as many people as possible take advantage of the products MNsure has to offer. We have made progress, and I believe our current enrollment numbers reflect that, and I'm eager to continue our path forward.
I think we'll try to get through the three overviews and then open it up for questions, if that's okay with members. Commissioner, I think, is this your first time before a legislative committee? Welcome.
Thank you.
In that context.
Thank you. And thank you for having me here, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Emily Johnson Piper, and I'm the new Commissioner of Human Services. I'm new to my role as Commissioner, having served in this capacity for about a month, but have witnessed both the successes of the ACA's implementation here in Minnesota, but also recognize that we still face challenges that I'm committed to working with you all to tackle in my term as commissioner. I share concern of many in this room about the issues that have affected Minnesotans who get health coverage through our public programs. Most recently, as a result of these challenges, earlier this month, DHS extended the renewal period for 2016 Minnesota Care and some 2016 MA enrollees to the end of this month. We did so because we were concerned about the low response rate, a delay in the 10-day notice closing to consumers, and the inability of the department to process the high volume of renewals received before the end of December. To me, this most recent challenge is an example of gaps in our business and IT infrastructure as they currently exist, resulting in gaps in service to the people that we are all here to serve. I know I'm not the only person in this room concerned and looking for opportunities to improve the way we do our work on a daily basis. I know the counties, our key partners in service, are frustrated. They're frustrated with the challenges that impact their abilities to effectively administer medical assistance, and I'm committed to working with them to improve the way we administer our programs going forward. I know that the people that we serve are frustrated. They're frustrated by letters they find confusing and long waits that they have to get answers to their questions. In the months since becoming commissioner, I have a newfound awareness for how many different mailings people have received from us recently and the quality of the communications that we send. There are lots of ways we can improve how we can communicate with people to make things clearer and more consistent going forward. People want to know what they need to do, by when, and how to get help with the process when they need it. We need to review and reform our business processes to address these issues. This effort will take time, but it's something I and my staff at DHS are committed to making a priority. In addition to this being a DHS priority, we continue to work with Minute from an IT perspective to make sure this is aligned with the work that's being done on our IT systems. The work to improve how we serve people with MA in Minnesota Care is work that must be done in partnership with Minute as our IT partner, as well as Curum, our IT vendor for METS. You may be aware that I recently sent a letter related to an error that led to a critical delay in sending closure notices to public program enrollees at the end of December. These notices did not arrive in enough time for people to find the status of the renewal and or to correct errors. This delay was a major reason we decided to extend coverage and extend the January renewal period. We were concerned that enrollees didn't have adequate notice that their coverage was due to end. These late arriving notices also created confusion for these enrollees about whether they would have coverage going forward. I expect to meet with IBM in Minute to discuss these concerns in the coming weeks. That said, so far in January, we've had more than 7,000 people renew their Minnesota Care and MA coverage this month due to our extended January renewal period, and more people are turning in the renewal forms every day. We're making extra efforts to reach out to public program enrollees so that they get their renewal forms back to us by the January 20th deadline to keep their coverage for February. There will always be some cases that are closed when we do renewals for various reasons, because they aren't eligible anymore, they've moved, or they've gotten other coverage. But going forward, we need to make sure we put in place practices that reduce the likelihood that we see churn for reasons related to confusion, untimely notice, or frustration due to operational issues. In the coming months, we have many tasks ahead, but I see three main areas of focus and lots of opportunities to make changes to better serve people: renewals, the MMIS interface, and premium functionality. I and my staff at DHS are committed to working to improve our business processes, work with IT on providing an infrastructure that supports our business, improve necessary controls to assure programmatic integrity, and ultimately make our business operations reflect more the needs of the people we serve. We can do better to serve the Minnesotans who get health care coverage through our public programs, and I'm committed in partnership to do that work. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Scott Peterson, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and present off your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Scott Peterson. I'm the work for Minute Services as a CIO of DHS and Minsure. I believe a handout was given on the roadmap. We had a lot of discussions around this last year, commonly referred to as the blue to green map, which is the way we track progress over the last year against the business priorities that were set. We set out to deliver on a very aggressive roadmap that would allow for a better user experience and also provide additional services to achieve better outcomes for the stakeholders. We worked the priorities that were set by business and were able to deliver on those activities with some notable exceptions, which you see on the chart. One is around carrier integration. We've had numerous conversations here around the carrier integration and the issues that we've encountered. We understand there's still work to do for business and the stakeholders, specifically the counties and the carriers. That work continues today and is currently being laid out in the 2016 roadmap. The spring release is already set with things Commissioner Johnson-Piper mentioned around notice improvements, interface improvements, as well as continued work on the carrier integration. The remainder of the roadmap is still being created. As business and IT assess additional input from the stakeholders, we anticipate that by 2:15, we will have the roadmap work completed and be transparent about that full roadmap and deliver to you at that time. On the carrier front, due to delays and the full effectuation logic implementation, we have work to do on both sides. We've received data from the carriers for the 2015 true-up activities, and that's already underway. This data is utilized to validate against the state system to generate the 1095s for both the IRS as well as the consumers. We recognize it has been difficult for the carriers as we started the process too late to deliver when we all would have preferred to. The carriers continue to collaborate with us, and we appreciate the partnership to ensure we can meet the needs of the consumers. The focus is currently on delivering the 1095. We have successfully delivered the first set of data to the IRS this past weekend for that process. We continue to work to deliver the necessary 1095s to consumers in a timely manner. From a county perspective, we continue to meet with the County Advisory Committee and react to requests as quickly as we can. Recently, we discussed some issues around renewals and related processing. We took that feedback, packaged a separate release to address some of those issues. The release has already gone through testing, and we're continuing to work with business to identify a window when we can deploy that package. We're also working with business to add additional county users to the roles that allow them to manage more cases locally, providing a better consumer experience and providing help to the consumers immediately. Minute understands the importance of a continuous, sustained effort to deliver additional functionality set through the business priorities. Like last year, we will be transparent about any items that are not delivered in the timing expected. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. So I think one of the things that I was looking at this is the 2015. There's a couple of blue items. 2016, you said, is going to be ready in the middle of February. February 15th, you'll have worked with all of the partners and your executive steering committee and have the roadmap for what is anticipated to be completed in 2016, along with cost estimates and the like as well? Is that
Mr. Chair, that's correct. So we'll have level of effort for the entire roadmap and be able to lay out the costs and everything associated to it. We continue to work with the counties on kind of re-level setting on what their most dramatic needs are, as well as carriers and just the public programs in general to determine, if business process changes are required or if it's technology fixes that'll be the quickest to assist.
And I know counties are a critical partner. We do have a place on the agenda a little later on to hear of the county's experience recently and their outlook for 2016 as we move forward. Questions of members? Representative Atkins, I know Representative Davids also, and then Representative Mack and Representative Hoppe. I should look to my left. Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. O'Toole, I wanted to talk to you about reducing the premium surcharge. And I shared this with you earlier, but my recollection of the fiscal note, which I think is permanently ingrained in my gray matter somewhere, is that when premiums reached this point, which is what the fiscal note anticipated. In fact, I think the fiscal note hit the premiums, frankly, they were lower, quite a bit lower than the fiscal note anticipated in the first couple of years of operation. But now they're exactly where the fiscal note anticipated. And the next paragraph in that fiscal note was that the expectation then was that the premium surcharge could be reduced to perhaps 2.75%, 2.5%. And I gave you a little bit of notice that this question was coming. Is that something that the board is going to take up in their budget discussions?
Ms. O'Toole.
Mr. Chair and Representative Atkins, thank you for the question. And so I mentioned this, I think, at a high level in my opening, but we are, and I would guess there are other questions about it, but we are launching into our next budgeting process. So that includes a look again at FY17, but also a more look that's further out from that for a three-year financial plan. Right now, I can tell you that the premium withhold has remained 3.5% across all of those years that we've projected. It will be part of the discussion. I can promise you that, and I will report back, as we dive into those conversations.
Mr. Chair, as a matter of fair warning, I wanted to ask the question today because at the next, assuming our next LOC meeting, Chairman Davids is after your budget setting sessions. That will be one of the, I don't know when you're going to, maybe it's tomorrow, Mr. Chair Davids, I don't know. But that's one I'll be curious to see what you and the board have determined and why, because that was a piece, we talk about the fiscal note a lot in this group, and that was, the premiums, frankly, were considerably lower, so I understood why the premium surcharge had to be higher. But now we've got the counter, where the bad news is the premiums have gone up to the point is what was anticipated. But perhaps that will lead to a reduction in the premium surcharge. So I look forward to having that discussion at the next meeting.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just a couple of questions for Minsure here. When Minsure says enrolled, does it mean all those who have paid and received insurance cards, or does it mean anyone who has applied through Minsure? What does that term mean?
Ms. O'Toole.
Mr. Chair, Representative Davids, thank you for the question. This is this is a real-time snapshot of our enrollment. So the 75,000 enrollments that I referenced earlier in my opening, those are folks that have signed up and enrolled in a plan, but effective either January 1st or February 1st and have not yet paid their premium. I think it is, so as time goes on, there's a little bit of a lag in that in getting that information, but we will be transparent about what our effectuated number is as we move along here, but a little too soon to say. That number that I gave you today is just enrolled into coverage.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Ms. O'Toole, are the Minsure premium tax revenue assumptions that were set in July based on the effectuated coverage or the number of people who applied?
Ms. O'Toole?
Mr. Chair, Representative Davids, those are based on effectuated numbers.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Ms. O'Toole, what kind of drop-off do you think we'll see in numbers for the people that are enrolled but haven't paid their first month's premiums? What, isn't it like 15 or 17% reduction?
Ms. O'Toole?
Mr. Chair, Representative Davids, I'd have to look again. I think we high level anticipate that whatever drop off will occur will be made up in people enrolling through special enrollment periods, but I can get back to you with a specific percentage if that's helpful.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. O'Toole, of those enrolled through December 15th, and we should know this, how many have received their insurance cards?
Ms. O'Toole?
Mr. Chair and Representative Davids, that would be, I don't know. That would be a better question for the carriers, because they actually send those out.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Ms. O'Toole, they have to have their 834s. From what I understand, they have to have everything so they can send them out. Has Minsure done everything it can do so the carriers can send them out?
Ms. O'Toole.
Mr. Chair and Representative Davids, I actually will ask for some help from Scott Peterson on this.
Mr. Chair, Representative Davids, around the 834, as we talked last time, I believe at the last LOC, around the process, the 834 generation is happening. It's happening daily now. There's two different avenues the carriers have the ability to take, processing what we termed as the CSV file, as we talked through it last time. So they have the opportunity to process that or the 834. We're in round 18 of 21 test rounds with the carriers currently. All the carriers to date have continued to use the data that's provided in that other format. So they're receiving those daily as well.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Davids.
Mr. Peterson, by what means? Are they still on Excel spreadsheets, or is this being done electronically?
So it's delivered electronically. It's in a CSV format, which is could be considered an Excel format, I guess. They get both transactions. They get the 834 EDI transaction as well as the CSV transaction.
And Mr. Peterson, you said that they're all using the CSV still as of this date?
Mr. Chair, with the exception of, I believe, the dental provider, Dentegra, is using the 834. The others are not.
Okay.
Well,
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe for Ms. O'Toole, how many people that were enrolled through November have actually paid their first month's premium?
Ms. O'Toole?
Mr. Chair, Representative Davids, and I apologize for having to for not having these answers right at the tip of my fingers. We are a team member down today, unexpectedly, but I can get that number for you. I'm not sure. There is a delay in when they're billed and when they're effectuated, but I can follow up with the committee.
Well, Mr. Chairman, and
Representative
O'Toole, the reason I'm asking these questions is because I want to see if there's an average fallout of like 15 or 17%. Is it greater? Is it less? Mm-hmm. And how does that affect the numbers? So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And so, Representative David, that's toward largely the budget piece that we'll find out more about, and we'll find out who's effectuated and what the average monthly premium that it's multiplied against. That's okay. Representative Mack, and then Representative Hoppe, and then Senator Benson. Representative Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have a few questions, but just one follow-up from Representative Davids, maybe to Mr. Peterson. So whether today or not, I'm not sure if it's possible, but in the next couple of days, would you have information on exactly how many 834s have been sent to the plans as of people who had enrolled by December 15th? Is that information readily available so we would know how many 834s have been sent out from Minsure?
Mr. Peterson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mack, absolutely. We can get you the numbers of the enrollees that have been sent over, yes.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Yep. Chair.
Representative Mack.
So I have a couple questions for Ms. O'Toole and then for the Commissioner. Ms. O'Toole, my one question was relating to the call centers, or it sounds like contact centers is what they're more accurately called now. Was there a plan in place, a crisis plan for situations that would allow for whether it's down people in the office, weather contingencies, things like that, a crisis plan to try to mitigate the effects that people would be facing when we know that we always know that the end of open enrollment, people leave it to the last minute. You know, these have been things we've heard over the last 3 years of Minsure existing. And so I'm wondering, one, was there a plan in place? And if there wasn't, is there one now going forward as a way of continually trying to tackle that issue of the long wait times that seem to keep happening at the very end?
Ms. O'Toole?
Mr. Chair and Representative Mack, thank you for the question. We always, like most businesses, have contingency plans in case unexpected issues arise. So, you know, the day on the 28th, we tried to get even more people on the phone from our end and tried to answer as many questions as we could. But also, we continued to work with consumers that we could identify who had issues that were not of their own making that couldn't get through on the 28th, so to serve them in certain ways and to get them enrolled into coverage. So there are always contingency plans in place. The you know, in terms of looking forward to our last deadline, as I mentioned in my opening, we are all hands on deck and ready to, you know, even we just made it through another deadline too with an average wait time of about 6 minutes, so showing really good progress in terms of that. We are also not going to be having a convergence of deadlines, which is, to my understanding, which was a big reason there was a lot of confusion out there. In addition, we've added more lines, trunk lines, if that means anything to anyone. So we have 600 trunk lines, so we can have a lot of people on the phone waiting for help if they need to, and we will make sure that those folks, whoever's on hold at midnight on the 31st, gets help. They will stay on hold, and we'll get the help and hopefully enrolled if that's what they're looking to do.
Okay. All you got to do is stay awake.
Yep.
Thank you, Mr.
Representative Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. O'Toole. And then my other couple of questions for you, Ms. Commissioner. I'm wondering, relating to the issue of Minnesota Care and some of the renewal issues that happened in December, I think anyone with an election certificate at the table heard from a lot of constituents. I have a whole email folder just with folks who were really confused, and I appreciate your comments at the beginning and commitment to try to make sure that the communication is better and more clear going forward. But given what happened in December, I'm wondering, we received a letter from you a few days ago explaining part of this process, and part of the explanation or the challenge was with some faulty instructions by IBM, as cited in your letter, that related to that. Are you able to point to or exactly where the breakdown was that led to a lot of people getting closure notices on their Minnesota Care and kind of sending them into a bit of a spiral and panic, wondering what was happening, and has it been remedied? Could you just shed some light on what went wrong there?
Commissioner?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Mack. I can do my best to explain the IT. Mr. Peterson might be in a better position to describe exactly what happened from an IT perspective. So everyone on Minnesota Care had to renew to maintain coverage effective January 1. So there were many people that didn't respond to the request for renewal to provide information that we needed to process a renewal application. At the same time, the monthly MA renewals were happening at the same time, and so there was a whole group of people trying to renew their MA. The issue with the IT related to the timeliness of the final notice. It's called the 10-day notice, and it's a closure notice. And an IT issue related to how the notices were to be generated out of our IT system caused those notices not to be generated at least 10 days before people's insurance coverage was set to terminate. So essentially what happened is there was a faulty command in the IT. This is just my understanding. You can correct me if I'm wrong. I'm not an IT person. There was a faulty command that was the command to generate the IT notices. So the command was entered. It generated notices. The notices were wrong. Before they were printed, it was realized they were wrong. But it took some time to figure out where the error had occurred in the IT. The error was discovered. The notice command was changed, corrected. The command was entered again into the IT system. The notices were regenerated, sent out less than 10 days before people's coverage was set to terminate. We made the decision at the business decision at DHS not to terminate people's coverage because people didn't receive adequate notice of their coverage terminating. So instead, we took that whole population, including some people who may have responded but whose information hadn't been entered into the system yet, but also people that hadn't responded at all, and placed them in coverage for the month of January. We then reissued the final notice so that they received a timely notice of their need to renew. And those people have coverage through the end of this month. If they don't provide the renewal information, the financial information necessary to renew them, their coverage will end at the end of this month.
Okay. And Mr. Chair.
Representative Mack.
Thank you. And thank you for that explanation. I think I followed you. The only question that I have is, and it's from some people I talked to personally, what would have happened in the situation as some of the people I spoke to where they sent in their renewal information sometime in, they, from what they told me and what they sent me to show me their documentation in plenty of time, even outside of that 10-day window, they had sent in their renewal information, still got a closure notice. Mm-hmm. So what happened there? Because, yeah, what happened there, Ms. Commissioner?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair and Representative Mack, there was a backlog of people whose information had not been entered yet into the system at the time the closure notices ran.
Okay.
And so likely what happened was those people had submitted their paperwork. That paperwork hadn't been validated and hadn't been fully entered into the system. So at the time the command was run, the system generated a closure notice, and that closure notice was sent out in air to those people.
Okay. Thank you.
That's the group of 6,200, we figure. Is that correct, the best estimate?
I can ask my assistant commissioner, Nathan Morocco, to get
Nathan.
I'm sorry?
I see Chuck and Nathan nodding their head yes. So.
Okay, good.
And Mr. Chair and Ms. Commissioner, how does it work? What's the impact for those folks, I think you said you extended the renewal process because of some of the glitches. And so how does it work on a practical matter for providers, for instance, not knowing who to bill? These people come in January. Is it all going to be fee-for-service for the month of January? And then if that's the case, how does that all get reconciled? Because obviously fee-for-service is not as efficient of a payment method as when they contract with a plan. But we also have contracts with the plans for a year, so we could be double paying for the month. So how are the mechanics of how that all gets reconciled budget-wise and otherwise going forward?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative Mack, I can ask Nathan Morocco to step up and explain the technical aspects of how we're going to bill. It is, we did put everyone in a fee for in that population who we auto essentially like auto continued their coverage for the month of January into fee for service, and Mr. Morocco can explain sort of the technical issues with that.
Assistant Commissioner Morocco, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and offer your answer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the record. Nathan Morocco, Assistant Commissioner for Department of Human Services, and Representative Mack. Actually, the Commissioner has it right on. So we do not pay the health plan for the month of January. They're on fee for service. Once we get the enrollment information into the system, then they'll go back on effective February 1st into the managed care organization.
One of the questions I think Representative Mack was asking was from the provider perspective, how does this work? I mean, if a Minnesota Care enrollee shows up at the hospital, is the hospital going to be familiar with how to handle the billing through a fee-for-service system for an individual who's, you know, been on PMAP prior? Is that going to cause issues? Is there a plan for how to deal with issues that it may?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, yes, there is. So we have a provider help desk, and this is a process that's pretty familiar with providers. They bill fee-for-service, they bill managed care. So we send a lot of messages, and we did a lot of messaging at the end of the year, particularly around pharmacies, which tend to be more point-of-sale oriented, explaining to folks the change. The basic message is if you don't find their eligibility in the managed care, try fee-for-service. And that gets 99% of the folks in. And for those who have difficulty, either in the provider side or the member side, then we have our service center that can help people sort of sort through what the eligibility and there continues to be messaging going out to providers explaining to them the change. We'll also emphasize that at the end of the month because we'll have folks transitioning back over to managed care. So again, it's a very familiar messaging system to providers, so it wouldn't be that unusual. But we recognize with the higher volume, there may be some folks who encounter situations, and that's what we're here to help them with.
One other subpart of that question was also, is there a risk of double paying both PMAP and paying fee-for-service, you know, for point-of-care delivery for the same enrollee? I mean, I think that was a part of it as well. Is there a risk of that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Mack, no. So the capitation payment cannot exist for the month of January for these folks. And then when they go into managed care, then it will turn off the eligibility of the fee-for-service system. So there will be no double billing.
Thank you. Representative Mack?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And so follow-up to that then, is there a change in the contract of what gets paid out in PMAP with the plans that helps to kind of make up what I would imagine will be some sort of a fiscal impact if for a month we're paying fee-for-service, which is a more expensive way of paying for care for these folks, and then switch back into PMAP? Is there an offsetting the contract, the plans get paid less because they're delivering 1 month less, and that will help fill in the gap of the fee-for-service? Is that essentially how that will play out, or will there be a bit of a hole in the budget because of 1 month of fee-for-service versus PMAP?
Mr. Morocco.
Mr. Chair and Representative Mack. So basically the capitation payment is per enrollee. So as we move somebody from fee for service, they just simply won't be in the cap payment to the plan. So if in December they had 1,000 people and now there's 500 less because we moved them to fee-for-service, then their cap payment would be based on 500 people. So from a health plan contracting perspective, there's no issue, and their amount is just simply reduced.
another sub-part of that question was the assertion that the PMAP is a more that the fee-for-service is a more expensive option for the month for that individual. Is that the case, or is it going to be more expensive for these individuals on, you know, for the population paid for through fee-for-service than if we'd covered them under PMAP?
So, Mr. Chair and Representative Mack's follow-up, no, not necessarily. So, under capitation payment, I mean, the models themselves are significantly different. So, under a capitation payment, it's as it's describing. It's a capped payment, regardless of whether services are incurred. So, if you're spending $500 a month for a client, they may seek $0 worth of services. They may seek $1 million worth of services. You don't know. The health plan is at risk. Under the fee for service, you simply pay for whatever services are incurred. So, you know, over the long term, it tends to be about cost neutral. But on a case by case basis, it can vary. We wouldn't expect with these sorts of numbers for there to be you know, much of a difference in an aggregate value, but we'll certainly follow up once we actually have the experience under fee-for-service.
Representative Mack.
Thank you, and I just have one last question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just while Mr. Morocco's at the table, it deals with Minnesota Care and kind of an ongoing conversation that we've had from the last oversight meeting. Just kind of an overall concern about the roller coaster that Minnesota Care enrollees have been on. I'm increasingly hearing from more people who are still wondering about their Minnesota Care bills. And so I'm looking for some sort of an update on where that's at. I know that, you know, there's quite a backlog of premium bills that have been sent to Minnesota Care. As far as I know, there were none sent out in the first half of 2014. I don't know if there's any been sent out in the latter half of 2014, but I'm just wondering if you could shed any light on where we're at in terms of Minnesota Care billing, how many Minnesota Care people currently are receiving accurate bills, and then does DHS have any type of a handle on what kind of a hole exists in the budget due to uncollected premiums for Minnesota Care? Because just as I look just briefly at past years, even pre-Minsure, what department would get in Minnesota Care premiums, I would imagine it's a hefty sum of money that is not with DHS right now that's uncollected from people on Minnesota Care. So any light that you could shed on that would be very helpful.
Sure, Mr. Chair and Representative Mack. So, so a few issues that you raised. So let me take these in a few different pieces. So part of what we had talked about at the last LOC was moving the premium process from EngagePoint, Curum, Met's system into MMIS, and that was scheduled for January of 2016. We are delaying that by a month because of the activity that we've been talking about here. So we're focusing on the renewals, making sure that folks get their 2016 coverage established. Felt that it would be very disruptive to the members to be, you know, switching the premium notices at this time. So that will be implemented now in February rather than January. So what does that mean? That means that the MMIS system will be generating the invoices. It also means that we will have the coverage contingent on payment process in place as well. So those were sort of two key components. One was accurate and timely notices, and the second one being ensuring that folks are actually paying their premium. Now, just to be clear, and we've talked about this before, recognizing that there is considerable reconciliation that needs to occur, we're only talking about payment of future premiums. So once that feature goes in, it's not about whether you paid in 2014 or 2015. It's simply when the premium notice goes out, we'll expect a timely payment. And in there, we'll also have information about how we intend to manage the reconciliation for clients. So they understand that you know, to be coming later this year is a process to reconcile both the 2014 and 2015 premiums, but here is the premium for 2016 going forward, and we will be requiring timely payment there within. So that's sort of the what are we doing now, and what does the next month or so look like in terms of reconciliation? That will occur towards the middle to end of September. So minute, and Mr. Peterson can talk a little bit more if we want details on it. But in essence, then what we need to do once we have the premiums going out is we need to reconcile sort of what has happened in 2014 and 15. And part of that reconciliation is just getting the data between the multiple systems to all be saying the same thing. Once we, and that's expected to be done in early to mid-summer. Once that's done, then my staff can go in and actually start the reconciliation process, meaning on a client-by-client basis, month to month, you know, what did we expect as the premium? What did we receive as the premium? In aggregate, obviously, if folks owe money, then we will be sending out a reconciliation for that. And for folks who are challenged by that, we'll certainly work with them on payment plans and how we can best get that money in. And if there are situations where we owe money, then we will certainly issue the refund to the client. So that's what we would expect to happen between now and, I'd say, 6 months from now. But again, primarily getting our first focus is just getting the premiums accurate and out the door, and that will happen starting next month. And Mr. Chair, if I could, just for a clarification, sure, on the prior question, just want to make clear that we are also, this has the transition to the fee-for-service. So we are in discussions with CMS, just ensuring that, you know, that they understand what we are doing and why we made the move that we did. And if there are any concerns coming from CMS about that, we'll certainly let the committee know. But we have to recognize that there are federal dollars at stake here as well. And so just want to be upfront about that.
And then I think Representative Murphy wanted to get in on this point, but then we're coming back, Representative Poppy.
Representative Murphy. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Mr. Morocco, and to the point about the cost neutrality between KeyMap, prepaid medical Minnesota Care, and fee-for-service, and claiming that they're, or asserting that they are cost neutral. Can you help me understand the foundation for that assertion, please?
Mr. Morocco?
Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, just simply, you know, when we've looked at in the past as to whether or not fee-for-service is more expensive or less expensive, it you know, over time tends to cost about the same. But that doesn't mean at an individual point, at a specific point in time or within an individual, you wouldn't see a cost difference between managed care and fee-for-service. But again, what we'll have to look at is what are the services that are actually incurred in the month of February? What would we have paid for those folks under capitation? And what will we pay for those people under fee-for-service? So as an example, if we were to exaggerate the situation and said 100 people are going to incur $100 million worth of costs, it would have been much cheaper under a managed care situation because we're simply paying a cap rate. Now, that's an exaggeration. I don't mean to imply that that's likely to happen, but it just illustrates sort of how the capitation process works versus the fee-for-service. The advantage of the fee-for-service, in this case in particular, is that we had many folks who did not respond to the renewal process and will not respond to the renewal process here, even under the extension. Under a managed care situation, you would be paying a capitation rate for all of those people who never really intend to continue their coverage in January and beyond. So that's the advantage of moving these folks into fee-for-service, is that we don't pay a cap rate for the likely tens of thousands of people who will not renew even after this extension.
So, Representative Murphy.
And thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Morocco, and I appreciate the deeper explanation about what you anticipate will be our experience this instance, but I am more curious about the fundamental question about the differential for the state of Minnesota between managed care and fee-for-service. And so if you would be willing to share with me over time, and we can do this offline, sort of the experience that we have over time between managed care and fee-for-service in our public programs, it would help me to understand better your thinking about the cost neutrality of that. I have questions about that, and I think we've made a number of decisions in public policy over the last few decades, understanding or believing that managed care was a means to deliver care through networks at a cost savings. And if it is actually cost neutral, and fee-for-service and managed care are equal in terms of cost for the state in our public programs, I think it would be important for me as a public policymaker to understand that as it will shape my thinking going forward. So I would love to have that conversation with you offline.
Okay, Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, would be happy to do that.
Mr. Chair, if I may, to
Senator Benson, on that point.
To one of Representative Mack's questions, and I might have written this down inverted. Did you say you're moving Minnesota Care out of Curum into MMIS for processing?
The billing.
The billing.
Mr. Chair and Senator Benson, that's correct. The billing portion. So METS or the Curum system will manage the eligibility for programs, but the actual and there is a calculation component that still resides in METS, but the actual print and distribution, sort of the final process, the final stage, will be carried out through through MMIS.
Thank you.
Representative Hoppe. It's taken a while, but.
No worries, Mr. Chair. Mr. Peterson, I've got, and I'm trying to read my notes here, but I've got a couple of questions. When we look at the chart, we have got a lot of green on there, and kind of something you were talking about with Representative Davids earlier. So when we look at this chart, we look at the IT progress, all of the things that are work completed. Somewhere in here, does it mean, and I kind of got the answer to this earlier, but does it mean that Minsure is not sending complete, accurate, usable, easily usable information to the carriers? And maybe if you could illuminate for me, and I think I know what the answer is, but if they get it as the CSV format, does that mean that somebody at Blue Cross or one of the other carriers has to do the data entry and follow up in any boxes on the spreadsheet that aren't filled in?
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hoppe, I can't speak to the business process they use on their side. I do know that these CSV files are consumable files so that they can be processed in the system. I know in speaking with some of the carriers that they have built processes around utilizing this data in that format currently, but I would hesitate to speculate how they're utilizing the file. To your question on the transfer of the data, we are transferring the 834 EDI. However, like I said, we're in round 18 of 21 of testing with them. They continue to want additional testing to be more comfortable that the file is accurate and complete and they can serve their consumers.
Representative Hoppe, I'm wondering, is there specific issues that are being found still in the reconciliation of the 834s and the continued testing?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hoppe, we have encountered some issues in detailed cases around things like term dates and things like that. The team, as the defects are addressed, just like the rest of our process, are corrected and they go back through the entire test scenarios.
And what are the size of these tests? And we'll keep on your
line. No, go ahead.
Yeah. What are the size of these tests? Are they sizable populations that are being run through the test so that if we were to flip the switch and go? I'm assuming that the carriers are thinking, if we go real time and we get swamped with all of these and there's even minor issues, it blows up into sort of a major issue. And so that's why the really thorough testing and also I know that the size of the tests has been a concern and making sure that we get a large enough test to have the comfort level.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hoppe, they're not widespread issues, I would say. We're getting into more detailed scenarios and more details around how the transaction works. To be completely transparent, we've really struggled with getting to the level of the comfort on both sides of what is enough testing. And obviously, we don't want to affect the consumers. And I believe at this point, the carriers have continued to utilize the process they were comfortable with, they knew that worked, and knew it wouldn't affect their consumers. So we just continue down testing with them.
Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your question. So, Mr. Peterson, I guess my assumption is that when everything is all done and all the boxes are green, the information that gets sent to whichever carrier it is will automatically populate whatever form they're using. So they'll be able to just go in and put in a policy number or a patient number or whatever it would be, and all of that accurate information will be there rather than them having to backfill or enter it in from a spreadsheet or whatever it would be.
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hobby, that's correct. So the process that should work, there's a lot of things in that one remaining box that's left there around reconciliation and the effectuation process, and that's a much longer term project where we will submit a file to them. They'll process it automatically. They'll send us back an effectuation automatically. We'll process on their side, that two-way communication back and forth.
Thank you.
Representative Poppy.
I think this question would be for Ms. O'Toole. So either 60 or 64,000 people last year, I wrote down two numbers, but I guess it's when you looked at it, 48,000 1095s that you said are going to go out. Is that a reflection of people that just aren't renewing? And is that, if it is that something that you kind of see as going forward, that you're going to have that kind of attrition every year? And are a lot of those people re-enrolling under something else?
Ms. O'Toole?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Hoppe. I think I would have to talk with Katie Burns about this in more detail. I'm happy to follow up with a conversation with you directly about that.
Well, I think even if there were attrition, if you had any month that you had an insurance policy purchased and paid, and I think you still get a 1095. So, I don't think it's the attrition issue of people who dropped off. I'm just trying to brainstorm here from knowledge.
And
Mr. Peterson.
Yes.
Looks like.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hoppe, so the 1095 is a requirement for us to send out to anyone who had coverage in any program throughout the year. So it's not a reflection of whether they're on or off now. It's for 2015 coverage by month.
Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So that, I guess that's what I was wondering. If we covered 64,000 people last year, why are we only sending out 48,000 1095s?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hoppe, it's by household. So the household gets a 1095.
Perfect. Okay. That is helpful.
I should have asked a better question in the first place. Thank you. One last 1095 question. Can MNsure automatically generate the 1095 forms, or is this, again, and I'm looking for automation here, is this something where somebody has to go and manually, not print these out, but do it manually somehow?
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hoppe, it's an automated process to generate them on the back end. There is a process that I spoke through in my opening comments that we're going through with the carriers now and the true-up, which is also part of that blue box that still remains there. So we're currently truing up with the carriers on the data because that real-time transaction isn't in place, and we generate the 1095s from that effectuated data.
Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Last question. What's the accuracy of what are you finding there with that process?
Maybe even compared to, I know other states have done and the feds have done the 1095s as well. How did we stack up last year and how we're looking for this year?
So, Mr. Chair and Representative Hoppe, I'll take a stab at this and can follow up with you with more detailed information. But last year, as you may recall, the federal government had a pretty high rate of error, like in the 20% percentile, I think. And we were well under 10% error rate, but I will follow up with more specifics. Are really focused on getting this done accurately and timely. That paid off last year. And I don't know, I can try and get more state-specific data as well.
We'll look forward to that. Is that it? I know Senator Benson, you had some questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Start with regarding the call center, December 28th, you have a contract with a call center vendor. Are you getting some money back from them for lack of performance?
Ms. O'Toole?
Mr. Chair and Senator Benson, thanks for the question. We have worked very closely with them, the vendor, to add additional staff to recover whatever resources were not provided on the 28th. So I don't know that we're getting money back. I don't know that we've asked for that. We've asked for additional resources to make up for that. But I can walk through, after talking with Katie Burns, more specifics around that.
Senator Benson.
So on the 28th, we needed more people.
That's right.
So then you called in staff. All right, everybody, stop Christmas.
come in, you're taking calls, which is expensive because if they were on vacation, I'm sure there's some provision. Okay. So now at the call center, when we don't need emergency backup, they're willing to have extra staff sitting around so that it sort of evens up. That doesn't really seem like a good deal for Minnesota. So please walk me through how Minnesota gets made whole.
Ms. O'Toole.
Mr. Chair and Senator Benson, maybe I misspoke. And I'm not talking about having extra staff when we don't need it, but having extra staff around the deadlines, for instance, last Friday, and then in 2 weeks on the 31st, we will have additional staff. I will be happy to follow up with you in more detail. I mentioned that we are down a team member today, but I am very happy to follow up with you. I have been in constant contact with the CEO of the Connection, which is our overflow vendor, and I'm getting hourly updates from them on how they're doing. And there have been arrangements made to even out what they have not provided to us. I'm not sure that we're getting money back, but we're getting the services we need for these next two deadlines at no additional cost. But I'm happy to have a further conversation with you and Katie when she's back.
Okay. And Mr. Chair.
Senator Benson.
And Senator Hayden, I'm just going to insert. People look at government contracts as pretty squishy, and if they can get more out of it, they're going to. That's how we ended up with stories of $1,000 hammers and $500 toilets. And they need to be held accountable for not having people in place. And if there wasn't an ice storm, why didn't they have people in Burnsville come off vacation and cover? And so, frankly, until we get some money back, they'll just look at us as patsies.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, I agree. I will follow up with you.
And Mr. Chair, I'm not done,
Senator
happily.
We'll come back.
I just wanted to ask to that point as just part of the process, because I think some of us may or may not know. Can you help us, Ms. O'Toole, understand how the flow? So is it? And I know I haven't done this work in a long time. I'll just leave it at that. But is there some trigger that says, you know, calls come in, your mentor staff who's answering the phone says, okay, we're over capacity, our wait time is 3.5 minutes, okay, that triggers something, or our abandoned rate is whatever, 10%, or abandoned rate is when people hang up, by the way. I used to do this, Mr. Chair. But something, some formula that triggers you to say, okay, this now needs to flow over to our overflow call center. So if you can help me understand how that works, because then I think it helps us all to understand kind of how you can predict that and how your vendor can predict that. And then secondly, help me understand the training that your staff gets at the call center, your main staff, and then the training that the vendor gets. And so is that simply to pick up the phone and start helping them through, or do they have extensive expertise to help them all the way through the transaction, or enough to answer the phone and figure out how to get that back to the expert at your shop? Help me understand that flow, because I think that would be helpful to the line of questions that Senator Benson went down.
Ms. O'Toole.
Mr. Chair and Senator Hayden, thanks for the question. We have so I'll try and work through all of your questions, and just help me if I've forgotten one. So we have an overflow vendor who we continually continue to maximize what they do. So they really handle most of the incoming calls right off the bat, and they know how they are trained. They're trained in a lot of the common questions that we get, for instance, just general questions we get, and a lot of the password resets. You know, when consumers don't interact with us maybe for a year or several months at a time, they forget their passwords, and we get a lot of that, and they can answer those very quickly. So trying to be really efficient with those resources. If those questions are more detailed, they are passed on to our more expert call center staff that's housed down right down the street at Minshew. Our team receives different trainings over, you know, the same training that the Connection does, but we have a much more specialized team that handles more complicated situations for Minnesotans. So we have more capacity. We are always looking at increasing our efficiency with the vendor and training them on more and more things, and we just do that on a continual basis. So always have our eye on that. In terms of the monitoring that goes down, some of you on the committee have seen this up close, and I invite all of you, if time allows, to do that. We are happy to show. But we do just second-to-second monitoring of all the calls that are coming in, both on from at our vendor and to our call center, to make sure we are maximizing, you know, keeping our wait times low and making sure we're getting to people as quickly as we can. So I think, Senator Lurie, you saw the person who is managing it. It's almost – it's like a game of strategy and how you're having people – move around or shift, and everyone's cross-trained so they can really help consumers, a lot of different consumers, but managed on really a second-to-second basis. And we also have shifts of folks come on. So we have, you know, most days we have lower call volume in the morning. We have high caller volume in the middle of the day and less as we near 8 o'clock on regular days. So we have more, you know, staff coming on throughout the day so we can better serve. So it's really detailed. It's complicated. It is done really literally on a second-to-second basis. And happy to walk any of you through that process and show it to you as well.
So Ms. Chair, and I want to let Senator Benson get back to her questioning. So it's a little, I was just talking to Senator Sharon, it's counterintuitive, kind of what you say. It's overflow. We would think that meant it overflowed into something else.
Yep.
But it actually is the point of your vendor is the first level of access for the most part, and then they start to make decisions based on the complexity of the calls that then flows into the more experts at Minsure, or I imagine if there's somebody available and it looks like the board is lighting up that they could actually pick up that call first too. But overflow is a term that I think I didn't follow. It's more of a front end service that we're looking at.
Mr. Chair and Senator Hayden, yes, and I, you know, these are terms that I just use, and I apologize. I think it a more accurate term would be a frontline vendor. Thank you.
Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Who audits the eligibility determinations?
Mr. Chair and Senator Benson, I think I will defer. I mean, we have a number of internal audits, I think, as does DHS, and external audits. But we have I'd have to get back to you with specifics. But we have, I think it's in a quarterly IVNB report that audits our whole system. We self-audit as well.
I know the OLA does an annual audit of eligibility for at least the public programs, but Senator Benson.
And they found errors, and errors keep, as the term we're creeping in. So, for example, if someone was told they were eligible for QHP when they were actually eligible for Minnesota Care, how did that slip through, and how do you fix it?
Ms. O'Toole?
Mr. Chair and Senator Benson, we, you know, I'll give you as much information as I can. So it depends on how we learn about that. We take some of those calls just issues that come through our call center, and we can handle those quite easily. Sometimes they come through an appeals process, which is a little bit more involved, although I think you would find at Minsure that we make an effort to make those that an expedited process. We do have a business team, an operations team that is managing, you know, our quality and eligibility across the board as well. If we have, you know, sometimes they're just mistakes. Our call center makes mistakes, or some of our partners do. But if there's something that is, and I'm not aware of anything that's more across the board, we would certainly address that in a different way. And I think Mr. Peterson might be able to assist as well.
Mr. Peterson, to that question?
Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, just in terms of the some of the issues you identify that the OLA finds, or when there's issues identified in the system, it does follow the same type of process where we work with business policy to define whether or not it is a defect or issue in the system. It's raised and then addressed in the system at that time.
And so, Mr. Chair, and I know everybody at this table gets emails and letters and things handed to them. So if someone was told they were eligible for Minnesota Care, paid their premiums without getting notices, they just kept writing because they were terrified they were going to lose coverage. Well, then told actually eligible for MA, and then to add insult to injury, got a letter saying that they were delinquent in their payments when she had all the canceled checks. I would love to believe you actually audited yourself and had controls, but this doesn't make any sense. And I have the papers showing you're actually eligible for MA. Oh, you paid all your premiums. Oh, by the way, you're delinquent in your premiums. So I'm really having a hard time believing you're as good as you tell us.
I mean, I think this goes to Commissioner Johnson Piper. Yes?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah. And Senator Benson, there are issues, obviously, and as you clearly stated, with our eligibility determinations that we're making in our public programs, and the OLA has identified those. And I'm wondering if Chuck Johnson or Nathan Morocco can come up and talk about our plan in the next year to solve for some of those, at least related to the public program pieces.
And, while staff is coming up, if somebody could address, so somebody's been paying premiums to a QHP for a year when they're actually eligible for Minnesota Care. How do you make that right?
Oh, were they paying Minnesota Care premiums, or were they paying QHP premiums?
These are two separate people.
Oh, okay.
So right. Both yep. had their eligibility yep. messed up. And one might be DHS, but the QHP is clearly yep. not. So if somebody paid a QHP for an extended period of time, how do you rectify that?
And Ms. O'Toole.
Senator Lurie and Senator Benson, thanks for the question. I think as soon as we are alerted to those situations, we try and work with the consumer to figure this out. And like I said earlier, we have a formal appeals process. Not everything has to go through that, though. But if it does, we try and expedite that. Because if it is something as clear as an eligibility situation, I can't speak to the specifics of this, but if it is a clear issue, we will work with a consumer so they don't have to go through a more formal process to rectify it. And sometimes it involves working with a carrier to rectify it as well, and with our partners at DHS. I think,
Mr. Chair, working Senator with the carrier, Benton. Would you expect the carrier to refund their money?
Ms. O'Toole.
Senator Lurie and Senator Benson, I don't know the specifics about this situation. I don't want to talk about hypotheticals without knowing more, but we do oftentimes work with carriers to make sure we're all dealing with the same facts and try and sort things out. I think it's all with the interest in helping the consumer as quickly as we can. And I think Mr. Morocco can talk about the situation with the Minnesota Care and MA.
And Mr. Chair,
Senator
to
Benson.
Button down the QHPs, you wouldn't ask the carriers to refund money when Minsure made an eligibility determination error.
Ms. O'Toole.
Senator Lurie and Senator Benson, again, I can't talk through hypotheticals. I can check. It doesn't sound right to me, but I'm not sure exactly the situation you're talking about.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, I'd appreciate a note letting us know that you're not expecting QHPs to refund when they've provided coverage if there is an eligibility error. And I'm fine with Mr. Morocco addressing. And I don't need the whole two-year plan. I just can't figure out how there's audits and eligibility. And we've been doing Minnesota Care for a long time. We've been doing MA for a long time. We talked a lot about how expensive churning was in the healthcare task force. That's got to be small potatoes compared to this mess. And so what do you do? First of all,
let's put on our commerce hat and pretend this was an insurance company. I cannot imagine members of the committee sitting quietly saying, oh, well, they just messed up and it'll get fixed and we'll give them 2 years. But when it comes to the entities we're responsible for, like, okay. And then they're going to come and ask for more money because they missed their Minnesota care premiums and they don't know how to get them back and it's not fair to consumers and all of that. And we're just kind of floating along. There will be more money because they'll say, oh, we can't serve people. And then they'll go to the press and say, we don't have enough staff to meet these needs. And so there will be more money. It shouldn't take 2 years. MMIS has been standing up for a really long time. You're moving from Curum back or to functionality, however you'd like to phrase it. And you're telling me you have auditors and you do internal audits and you're checking eligibility. You can't be doing that and have stories like this be true. So I guess I don't even need to hear you've got a 2-year plan because we've had a 3-year plan and we've had internal auditors. And so really, when is somebody going to get fired or somebody going to be held accountable? When are the taxpayers going to get the value that they put into all of these systems? When is somebody going to have mercy on the consumer who gets the letter in the mail that says you're no longer eligible, but the date of the postmark on the envelope is after their 10-day termination? I would really like to know when somebody is going to get sick to their stomach about that and shake something up and make it happen in less than 2 years and not for $10 million. So if anybody has that question answered, I would love to hear an answer. Because the people of this state, A, deserve better, and they've been through enough. So, Mr. Morocco, if you can tell me how you're going to do it in less than 2 years for under $10 million, I'd love that.
Mr. Chair and Senator Benson, I'm not sure that I can answer that question directly.
Just because it was an awkward silence, I thought I'd fill it, the room. I am curious to, and this might have been answered, so I know that we got some systems issues. You guys have outlined those. You guys have outlined the numbers. When we looked at some of the OLA report before, there was a lot of, you know, trying to interpret that data in a snapshot at times that we weren't doing really well. Like, and Senator Benson talked about it, either you're eligible for one program, so you're eligible for MA, but you got Minnesota Care, then there was a lot of talk about where you were actually eligible to be in the QHP or Minnesota Care, but you got an MA, and then what was the cost to the state? I can remember, Senator Lloyd, there was all of this kind of talk about that and what the net outcome was for the state in terms of costs, what it was for the plans, what it was for the consumers. I guess what I'm just trying to get at is that is the stuff that we hear, and often what we often hear, no matter what it is kind of the worst case scenario, or what someone finally gets fed up and writes the paper about. What I'm trying to understand is how much of that is an everyday occurrence that you're trying to fix versus how much of that is just really kind of a few folks that really have just kind of that are outliers in terms of what the problem is. So, Ms. Morocco, we've talked before about, you know, you just talked about a switch didn't happen, and so you just took that subset of folks, extended them out, and then you're filling in the backlog, and then you fixed it. But how much of it is all of this miscategorize people in terms of their eligibility? What's your sense, Mr. Morocco, of how much of that is happening? And you may not have an answer, but that's what I think we all want to know. Right. Yeah, I think that's why you're the chair. That's what I'm trying to articulate, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair and to Senator Hayden, I'm not sure that I could quantify it as a percent. What I would say is that we're more confident today in the eligibility than what we would have seen even 6 months ago. And I say that because even in June of 2015, we were still doing renewals that were January renewals. So, I certainly appreciate Senator Benson your frustration. I think the commissioner presented her frustration, and I'm frustrated as well. So, what we look to is a system that can help us do the things that we need to do. As far as eligibility goes, it's relatively good at this point. I mean, if we know that the eligibility rules themselves are working well. When somebody comes in, puts in their household income and the household composition, it is able to sort out whether they're MA, Minnesota Care, or QHP. Do we have a percent or not? That's to be determined as we audit sort of this point in time. I think what confounds the administration at this point, the administration of the programs, is just as you described, Senator, and as others have mentioned here, it is in the notices, the fact that there's a Minsure logo on a MA letter on for an MA program. That's confusing. When somebody has an appeal question and it's the Minnesota Care phone number, or I'm sorry, it's the Minsure phone number, when somebody has an appeal question, that's confusing. So we know that premiums are not going out accurately and timely. That's not only confusing, but that's not good for program integrity. So what we know is that when folks come into the system, that part works generally well. What we want to fix is, as we've described here today, is the premium process, which is moving back to MMIS. And so we're hopeful then, starting in February, that those will be accurate and timely. What is slated for the roadmap for 2016 for fixing these problems, I didn't see the handout that came out, but it may or should have notification listed on there as one of the projects, is on our project roadmap for 2016. And notifications are going to be something that's going to be on our radar for the entirety of 2016. The unfortunate reality is that we have a lot of touch points with our clients. There are a lot of notifications that need to be adjusted and made to work better, and that will be part of our METS roadmap for 2016. So, to Senator Hayden, my apologies for the long answer, but I can't give you a percentage, but I can say that folks that are coming on, we do feel confident that part is working well, and that it is doing accurate determinations, but we know that we have a long way to go in terms of what happens after that, really managing the case, communicating to the clients. That's the part that really needs to be significantly improved.
So one thing I'll tease out from your answer, it was the 2015 roadmap that we saw. So we weren't presented with the 2016 roadmap because it's not complete. It'll be done on February 15th is what Scott Peterson said. But it's actually reassuring to hear that from DHS's perspective, at least two members of the 7-member executive steering committee, that cleaning up the notification process is going to play a prominent role on the 2016 roadmap, it sounds like, what you said. Commissioner Piper, and then Senator Hayden wants to finish up, and then
thank you, Mr. Chair. I just, to your point, Senator Benson, there are a lot of things that we can do operationally that aren't going to cost a lot of money that are going to help our consumers and help people coming in and trying to enroll or renew in our public programs. And they shouldn't cost money. It's just simply resetting how we're looking at how we're communicating with people in a way that makes more sense for a regular person.
Senator Hayden?
Good. Well, I think just as a follow-up to that, Mr. Morocco and Ms. Johnson-Piper, is the Senator Benson referred back to MMIS. You know, it's like the romanticism of the years gone past. But it was a stable system, and we are moving, and we had to move no matter what because it was a legacy system. So whatever we choose, so I just think we all always need to think about that, and always think that the days gone past were the best days. But I've worked on that system, and it was tough. But here's my question. We had some controls in place then to look at eligibility, to take some sampling, to make sure that and sometimes it was just about the worker, making sure that they were putting in the data correctly so that the system can calculate the eligibility. So there's always has been this issue of making sure that the person who's putting in the data or however the data is now populating the database, then the database is doing it correctly, and then you guys got this other kind of mess, if I may say, about who they call and why. Are we, do we still have that in place where there's this random sampling or auditing to just make sure that each component of the system is calculating it right? It sounds like you said, Ms. Morocco, it was that the people who are putting in the information is putting in exactly what it is. There's even one step before that to ensure that the people who are giving you the information are giving you accurate information based on the be eligible. Is there, that's a long question just to say, are those, did any of that really change as you started to convert to more automation to figure out eligibility?
Mr. Morocco?
Mr. Chair and Senator Hayden, if I could, I'd like to follow up with you and be more specific about what we do, just so that we're accurate about that point.
One thing I'd like to say, you were talking about the romanticism of the prior. You know, it's, we have to be careful because, like, I'm romanticizing about the day when Minnesota Care was at 275% too, so I'm waxing romantic as well, and so we have to...
Well, Mr. Chair, I will be careful with that. Some things in the past were better, but we do have to move on.
We do. Other questions of members? That's right, I'm sorry. Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe to Mr. Morocco. What percentage of MinCare enrollees received a premium invoice each month in 2015? In other words, they were billed properly each month.
Mr. Morocco.
To Mr. Chair and to Representative Davids, I can get a percent for you. I don't have it off the top of my head. What I would note is that, as I referred to earlier, we were having issues with renewals. I think everyone's well aware of that. Anybody under a renewal would not have been receiving a premium notice for most of 2015. Once the renewal was completed in mid to late summer, then the premiums would have started to be generated. So it's a long way of saying January. A snapshot of January would look different than a snapshot of September. But let me get that information for you. September would have been, you know, nearly 100% at that point, and January probably would have been less than 50%. But I can get you the specifics.
Okay. And then my follow-up question, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Morocco, since January of 2014, what is the total, and Representative Mack kind of went around this a little bit, what's the one concern I have is the tremendous amount of uncollected premium. What's an update on that? How much money has not been collected since January 2014?
Mr. Morocco.
Mr. Chair and Representative David, so once we start the reconciliation process, we'll have a more specific number, and we'll certainly share that with the group. What we have projected is in fiscal year 15 is about $10 million, and then there would be some increases going forward. So fiscal year 16, 17 would be about $13 million. These are obviously projections at this point, but that gives you about a ballpark of where, you know, what we're looking at from a DHS perspective at this point. It obviously depends on when the reconciliation process starts. Again, we're projecting sometime in mid to late summer, and then of course the how long it takes us to collect the monies will also impact that as well.
Well, Mr. Chair, Mr. Morocco, what's the plan for collecting? Because these are, as a rule, low-income folks, and if they get a bill for $7,000, how do they pay that? How do they do that? How's it going to work?
So, Mr. Chair and Representative Davids, so what we would anticipate is doing a full audit on each account, and then the communication going to the client would include that audit, meaning, you know, I think the onus is on us to demonstrate that we believe sort of month by month, you know, for 14 and 15, what is owed. And then we would expect payment. To the extent that a client needs help with that payment, if they need a payment plan, we're certainly here to work with them. We've been pretty upfront with folks that there is no cancellation of coverage for failure to pay the premium. That's why getting an accurate premium started and out the door and making coverage contingent on future payments, an important piece just so we can stop that, so that we're only really reconciling for, you know, for the two years. But again, we will work with clients. We understand the hardship that you know, that the system has placed them in, and we'll work with them as best we can.
But just for putting it in perspective, I mean, I think the number $7,000 was thrown out there. My understanding is the maximum monthly premium for 14 and 15 was $50 a month. I think. I mean, I think $600, less than 10% of the figure you threw out. It would be the maximum if nobody paid anything for a year. So, I mean, I just,
and Mr. Chairman, I picked a number out of the air. I had no idea there. Now, to the commissioner, another issue here we're looking at is the shop waiver. By law, you were to try and get a, you know, the shop waiver. This is Hawaii's shop waiver right here.
That's Hawaii's 1332.
This is ours. Is there more coming, or what do we have here?
Well, I can let Mr. Morocco speak to the specifics, but it's my understanding that Hawaii hasn't submitted that waiver yet, in part because shop waivers are not available until 2017. It's my understanding that we're submitting this as a starting point, which is consistent with how we've engaged CMS on issues in the past, and anticipate that we will, that that's the start of our dialogue with CMS going forward.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative Davids, the Commissioner, I think, has stated it well. So when we were talking to legislators about this issue, we were talking about a 1332 waiver for those involved in the task force. That's a very familiar topic. The 1332 waiver from the state of Minnesota was not coming anytime soon. It certainly hasn't happened yet. And a 1332 is a much more comprehensive waiver. It really is taking a look at the entire marketplace and really asking for, you know, sort of big global changes. And I would fully expect the state at some point to engage in a 1332 type waiver. Again, in speaking with legislators, there was the desire to get a conversation moving quicker on the shop waiver. We were not familiar with another process outside of the 1332, and so feeling a bit stuck, what we decided to do was to just contact SSIO and to work with CMS to say, look, this is what our state is asking for. We want to understand are there other options outside of 1332. We know that we're going to go down that route, or we can go down that route in the near future. But we're looking for any other options that might exist now. So that's why the letter is brief. It doesn't compare to the Hawaii, because the Hawaii is a true 1332 waiver. It is much more comprehensive. It goes well beyond the walls of just simply asking for a shop waiver. And as part of the legislation that you passed in 2015, you know, you have 30 days. Minsher Board has 30 days. If folks would prefer us to say something different, to frame it differently, we can certainly do that. But this was really just to start the conversation to say, what other options might we have? Who do we even work with, either in SSIO or with CMS? I mean, are we in the right place? Is there anything that we're not aware of? That's really what the intent of the letter was, and that's the reason for its brevity.
So, Mr. Morocco, you have not sent this letter, or Commissioner, you have not sent this letter to the feds. You've circulated it to Minnesota stakeholders to get feedback ahead of sending it to the feds. Is that what I'm hearing?
More specifically to the LOC and to the board, to the Minsher board. So if we want to be more specific about, or I should say if you want to be more specific, that's certainly within your purview. We'd be happy to you know, take any suggestions that you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Other questions of members? Representative Murphy.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. We have spent a lot of time now, you know, examining the work that you're doing. So a couple of points. First to Ms. O'Toole. I appreciate very much your persistent determination in getting Minsher to the place where we want it to be as policymakers. And, you know, you've come into a position that probably is not the most popular position in state government. I would say that. And you manage that with a lot of grace, and I appreciate it. And I am grateful to you and your team, everybody at Minsher, DHS as well, for sticking with a hard charge. Minsher wasn't given a whole lot of time to get up and running, and, you know, it certainly caused problems. Our delay caused problems. So I want to first and foremost thank you for that. To the questions about Minnesota Care and MA and the issues that we're having with the enrollments and renewals, I would really appreciate it if we could get, you know, past the questions, which are important, to understand how this is working for Minnesotans and to better understand what is the root cause, right? Because I would imagine that there are a number of root causes. In my tenure here in the legislature, I have worked with past administrations before Governor Dayton was elected to try and resolve some of those underlying problems with the technology, with the way that we enroll people, with the underfunding for that. And I was not successful back in whenever that was, 2009, I suppose, 2008. And I am really interested, if there's an interest, to continue to work to see if we can understand what those root causes are and fix those. I think Minnesota Care and MA are, you know, important. We know that the people that are enrolled in those programs are vulnerable for a number of reasons, largely because they're sick. And so I want to make sure that we're delivering the best service that we can for them, and I have confidence that we can do that. But I know that you're dealing with some legacy issues, some complicated issues, and I just want you to know that as a member of the legislature, I want to work on those with you. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions of members? Seeing none, we'll move on to the county experience. I think I see Marty Fishbach and Deborah Huskins. Thank you for hanging around for quite a while. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon.
Thank you. I'm Marty Fishbach, Director of Employment and Economic Assistance in Dakota County. Thank you for the opportunity to provide some information about the county's experience in serving people through the MNSHR system. Just some general comments about where we are at. In the later months of 2015, there were a number of improvements in the ability to serve our clients. So, for example, we've been able to help in urgent situations since DHS implemented they call it a 911 line. And that has really helped escalate cases where people had a medical emergency. In addition, system functionality provides the ability to make certain types of enrollees' cases, cutting back on time spent on lengthy processes. So that was another enhancement in 2015 that was helpful. And these things have been helpful. Unfortunately, our current functionality is still not where we need to be in order to work efficiently and effectively. We continue to manage cases in a reactive mode as opposed to being proactive. So just to explain, counties work a life cycle of a case, and that would be application, determining eligibility, updating a case when changes occur, renewal of a case, and then closing a case. And the state has made a lot of progress in the functionality to manage this case throughout the life cycle, but we still can't do everything that we would like to. That we can't manage every case through the life cycle every time. Meanwhile, we have not gotten functionality that we really need to manage a large volume of cases. Just to throw out a couple examples, we have a lot of duplicates that need to be managed, and we're tracking numerous cases for various reasons. And when I say we're tracking these cases, I mean we're manually tracking these cases, like on an Excel spreadsheet, and then having to go back through and pour back over these types of items. So those are some of the issues we have around volume. I'm going to turn it over to Deb.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Deborah Huskins. I'm an area director with the Hennepin County Public Human Services and Public Health Department. And thank you, Marty. I do want to focus on the cumulative effect of some of the developments on the county workers. Unfortunately, the heavy renewal work in the past several months is having a cumulative effect on counties and frontline workers in particular. There are several issues that are piling up right now. The catch-up in the renewal work has been very resource-intensive. Many counties have the same staff who deal with a number of programs. They're not just dealing with MNSHR. And the changes in these other programs as well are occurring, resulting in very heavy caseloads, additional complexity, and staff burnout. I will say that morale is getting to be quite a challenge in many counties. We now have more medical assistance cases in METS than we do in our legacy system, which is pretty interesting. The balance has shifted now. In Hennepin County, for example, we have over 82,000 enrollees who are enrolled in medical assistance through METS rather than in MAXIS. There's a backlog at the state, as you know, not only in phone calls to the help desks, but also in help desk tickets. As Marty mentioned, we can push through urgent needs, and that is working very well. but this is a good illustration of the lack of ability to manage cases proactively. Very soon, 1095B tax forms will be sent to consumers early in February, and the name and phone number of the county will be on those tax forms. The questions will come to the same workers I was just talking about. We expect that this will generate another spike in phone calls. Elimination of duplicate cases would save a great deal of time, as Marty alluded to. I also want to mention that the interface between METS and MMIS does not consistently work. And when there's an issue that's related to MMIS, it often generates the need to send a ticket to MMIS to have the state handle that rather than the county's ability to handle that. In recent weeks, in particular, the renewals has been a huge push for counties as well as the state, particularly to complete January renewals in time for February. And we are working on February renewals, and then the March and the April and the May renewals will be coming very shortly. Many counties are reporting that they will not be able to complete all of the January and February renewals by the end of the month. And as I mentioned, February, March, and April renewals will continue to be quite high and continue to come in. We are hoping for some fixes and tweaks to the process in order to improve the renewal processing in the coming months, and I think Mr. Peterson alluded to some of those. We had a very constructive discussion about a week and a half ago, and there were some ideas generated that the state is taking a very serious look at. However, we still worry that it will not be enough for counties to get caught up and maintain a timely process, let alone to get out of the reactive mode and into a proactive managing our caseload. I do want to close my comments by saying that we are having an ongoing problem-solving dialogue with DHS and Minute leadership. They are very accessible to us, very open, very responsive, and I think it's a very constructive conversation that we're able to have. Counties want to do the very best they can and bring whatever we can to the table to help resolve issues. It's a difficult place we're all in right now, but we appreciate the openness of the state. We hope this information is helpful, and if you have any questions, we'd be happy to try to answer them.
Ms. Fishbach, Ms. Huskins, thank you for your continued service from the counties and helping bring that perspective forward. It's one that I know we all share a deep commitment to the work that you do. Any questions of these testifiers? Well, seeing none, we'll move to the last item. Thank you for your testimony. We'll move to the last item on the agenda. Is there anyone from the public who wishes to offer testimony? Mr. Neumeister, welcome to the new Senate office building. Is this your first testimony here?
Yes, it is.
Welcome.
Co-chairs, members of the task force, my name is Rich Neumeister. I'm very much aware that this is about MNSURE Operations Committee, and let me just give you my two cents as how I view how MNSURE has changed and some of the things that have been said in the public. I was one of the first folks that went through MNSURE a couple of years ago for my insurance, and admittedly, there were issues there. I'm very much aware and astute that things have improved. Now, in the newspapers lately, and this is how I felt when I read about the 6,200 people that were left behind or somehow or whatever, and I had to take a look at the big change that was done bipartisanly about, and what I mean bipartisanly, I mean in terms of the law that changed the competitive bidding process and all that, which then made a situation where one of the providers may not be able to get part of the pie or to serve Minnesotans, and that was UCare. So the fact was that you had hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people that had to do a changeover. And the point is that if, from what I read of the newspapers, that 6,200 people, there might be a little bit more, but out of the hundreds of thousands that had to go from one provider to the other or whatever, I think there has to be some good things said too. That there, you know, that a lot of people, there were problems and issues, yes, but I think A lot of people did get their provider. They did get their, you know, insurance card. They got their thing by the first of the year. And granted, there are some people that got caught in the changeover of the system. But that happens. It wasn't hundreds of thousands. It was at least 6,000, maybe a little bit plus. But I think because of the decisions you made to go through a competitive bidding process to where hundreds of thousands of people had to change for 2016, I think you could applaud the institution or whatever. At least it didn't get into the 20, 30, 40, 50,000s where there's a big catastrophe. And yes, it's been hard on the counties. I'm aware of people who have received double notices, you know, and that happens. But hopefully the Department of Human Services will react accordingly and appropriately to help change those things, which they did according to the newspaper article I read today, that January, you know, there's a pass. The other only item that I would say, this is me personally, because I'm familiar with MinCare. There has been generally a relaxation of the policy that if you don't pay your premium for that next month, which MinSure sends out the bills, there's been a general rule that says then you don't get medical coverage for that particular, that next month. So let's say you got at the end of this month, you have to pay for February. I think you should go back to that rule. Again, after if everything is flushed out, the general rule should be if you don't pay your premium by, you know, that date, you don't get coverage for that month. It used to be the old rule. But what has happened, and there are people that are caught in this, is that there are a lot of people who owe the state of Minnesota their premiums. Whether or not whenever that's going to be sorted out, I have no idea. But there are people who owe money for 2015 that somehow they should be getting their bill. Even though it's small, but it's still part of the premium that could be helpful to keep MinSure going or MinCare going in the long run. I was around, again, this is the end of my fourth decade here, and I was one of the people that slept in room 15 for two nights in a row. We didn't, you know, some slept, some not, whereas the gang of seven was going around the halls trying to figure out how MinCare was going to be. I believe in MinCare. Now, I know that some people may not or they have other proposals, but I do believe in MinCare, and it's been a very positive thing. And I would like to encourage the more money that you can get into MinCare or the general fund, like the premiums or whatever, the better it can in the long run last. Whether or not with the 2019 shutdown, that will be a different topic and a different issue, and hopefully wise people can figure that out with the funding and the provider tax for that MinCare can continue on. So those are my comments. I may have strayed a little bit, but I think I've been pretty much right on in terms of some aspects of what your operational committee does.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to offer testimony? Seeing none, thank you, members, for your attendance and your questions, and thank you to the administration and MinSure for coming forward and answering, and we'll look forward to those follow-up items. With that, we stand adjourned.